Scene 17.
3 days later, I was alone in the tower, getting ready for the mask and our truncated performance of Romeo and Juliet. The costumers had dressed us in a style they described as carnival couture, which, as far as I could tell, adhered to no particular time period, but called for a lot of velvet and gold embroidery. I checked my reflection in the mirror, turned from side to side. I looked like a musketeer, but a particularly flamboyant and well-funded one. The half-cape they'd given me was slung over one shoulder and tied with a sparkling ribbon in the middle of my chest. I tugged at it self-consciously. James and the girls had already gone, except Wren, who, as far as we knew, was still bedridden in the infirmary, and I had only a few minutes to spare. I tried to pull my boots on standing up, but quickly toppled sideways onto my bed and finished the job from there. My mask sat on the nightstand, watching me with hollow eyes. It was a beautiful, enchanted sort of thing, crisscrossed with lines of gold and painted with diamonds in shimmering blue and black and silver. As they'd been measured and made for us by the art students and wouldn't fit anyone else properly, we'd been told that we could keep them. I tied the silk ribbon behind my head with fumbling fingers, muttering my first lines under my breath, then took one last look at myself and hurried down the stairs. Alexander was in the library, but at first I didn't even recognize him, and he startled me so badly that I stumbled backward. He looked up from where he was crouched over a fine line of white powder on the coffee table. His keen eyes watched me through two deep holes in a green and black mask, wider and less delicate than mine, tapering to a sharp, devilish point at the end of his nose. "What are you doing?" I asked, more loudly than I meant to. He twirled the tube of a ballpoint pen between his fingers and said, "Just getting a bit of a buzz before the ball. Would you like to join me?" "What? No, are you serious?"
"I am more serious than my custom. You must be so, too."
He bent his head over the table and sniffed hard. I turned away, unwilling to watch, furious with him for some elusive, incoherent reason. I heard him exhale and looked around again. The line was gone, and he sat with his hands on his knees, his head tilted back, eyes half closed.
"So," I said, "how long has this been going on? Are you going to scold me?"
"It would be well warranted," I said.
"Do the others know?"
"No." He lifted his head again and watched me with unnerving intensity.
"And I expect it to stay that way."
I glanced at the clock, mind worrying.
"We're going to be late," I said shortly.
"Then let's go." I left the library without waiting to see if he would follow. We were on the trail, halfway to the hall, when he finally caught up and fell in step beside me. "Are you going to cold shoulder me all night?" he asked, so casually that I was sure he wouldn't care if I did.
"I'm considering it, yeah."
He laughed again, but the sound had a false ring to it. I moved impatiently forward. I wanted to get away from him, lose myself in a press of people I didn't know, and avoid thinking about it for another few hours. The cape hung heavily on my shoulders, but the cold crept underneath, gnawing at my skin through the thinner layers of my shirt and doublet.
"Oliver,"
Alexander said, and I ignored him. He could barely keep up with me, lungs working hard to convert the frigid air to something breathable. Snow crunched under our feet, brittle and icy on top, soft, dense powder underneath.
"Oliver! Oliver!"
The third time he said my name, he grabbed me by the arm and wrenched me around to face him.
"Are you really going to be a twat about this?"
"Yes."
"Fine. Look."
He was still holding my arm, too hard, fingers crushing down through the muscle until they reached bone. I gritted my teeth, almost sure he didn't even realize he was doing it, unwilling to acknowledge the more troubling possibility that he did.
"I just need an extra little kick to get me through exams. I'll be clean when you see me in January."
"You better be,"
Have you even thought about what'll happen if Colborne finds that shit in the castle? He's just looking for a reason to tear this whole thing open again, and if you give him one, I swear I'll kill you.
He stared at me, mask to mask, with a wary, suspicious look I didn't quite recognize.
What's gotten into you? He said. You don't sound like yourself.
Yeah, well, you're not acting like yourself. I tried to drag my arm out of his grip, but his fingers were locked around my bicep.
You're smarter than this. I'm not keeping any more secrets for you. Get off me. Let's go.
I tore my arm free and turned my back on him, plunging forward into deeper snow. Scene 18. Alexander shadowed me up 3 flights of stairs. The ballroom stretched skyward from the 4th floor to the 5th, with a long balcony and a sparkling glass atrium that stabbed up at the moon. The Christmas mask was traditionally spectacular, and the winter of 1997 was no exception. The marble floors had been polished to such a high shine that the partygoers might as well have been walking on mirrors. Weeping fig trees, which grew out of deep, square planters in each corner, were bedecked with tiny white lights and strands of ribbon and wire that sent flashes of gold darting around the room. The chandeliers, strung on thick chains that stretched from wall to wall 10 feet above the balcony, let a warm glow fall across the crowded floor. Tables cluttered with bowls of punch and platters of tiny hors d'oeuvres lined the west wall, and the students who had already arrived clustered around them like moths around a lantern. Everyone was dressed their absolute best, though their faces were hidden. The boys all in white bauta masks, the girls in small black moretas. Our masks were overwhelmingly elaborate by comparison, made to stand out in a sea of blank, anonymous faces. The orchestral students had gathered on one side of the room with their instruments, sheet music propped up on elegant silver music stands. A waltz, airy and beautiful, swelled under the ceiling. As soon as we entered, heads turned toward us. Alexander went immediately forward into the crowd, a tall, imposing figure in black and silver and serpentine green. I lingered at the door, waited for the staring to subside, and then began a slow, inconspicuous walk around the edge of the room. I searched for sparks of color, hoping to spot James or Philippa or Meredith. As on Halloween, we didn't know how it would begin. Expectation vibrated in the room like an electrical current. My hand rested on the hilt of the knife in my belt. I'd spent 2 hours on Tuesday afternoon with Camilo learning the combat of the play's first duel. Who was Tybalt, and where had he hidden himself? I was ready. The orchestra fell silent, and almost immediately a voice called out from the balcony,
"The quarrel is between our masters and us, their men."
2 girls, both 3rd years, I thought, were leaning out of the balcony on the east wall, plain silver half-masks hiding their eyes, their hair drawn tightly back from their faces. They were dressed as boys in breeches, boots, and doublets.
"'Tis all one," the second one said. "I will show myself a tyrant. When I have fought with the men, I will be civil with the maids and cut off their heads."
"The heads of the maids?" "Aye, the heads of the maids, or their maiden heads, take it in what sense thou wilt."
They affected bawdy, masculine laughter, which was enthusiastically rejoined by the onlookers below. I watched and wondered how best to enter to stop their dispute, but as Abraham and Balthazar, also 3rd-year girls, entered on the ballroom floor, Gregory and Samson swung their legs over the balcony wall and began to climb down the nearest column, fingers gripping tightly in the greenery wound around it. As soon as they touched the floor, one of them whistled, and the 2 Montague servants turned. The biting of thumbs, accompanied by more indulgent laughter, turned quickly to an argument. Gregory.
"Do you quarrel, sir?"
Abraham.
"Quarrel, sir? No, sir."
Samson.
"If you do, sir, I am for you. I serve as good a man as you."
Abraham.
No better?
Samson.
Yes, better, sir.
Abraham.
You lie!
They dissolved into a clumsy four-way duel. The audience, pushed back now to the edges of the room, watched in keen delight, laughing and cheering their favorites. I waited until I felt the fight was ripe to be interrupted, then ran forward, drew my own dagger, and drove the girls apart.
Part fools, I said. Put up your swords. You know not what you do.
They fell back, panting hard. But the next voice came ringing from the opposite end of the room. Tybalt.
What, art thou drawn among these heartless hinds? Turn thee, Benvolio. Look upon thy death.
I wheeled around. The crowd had parted around Colin, who stood staring at me through the eyes of a black and red mask, the sides cut sharply back from his cheekbones, angular and reptilian, like a dragon's wings.
Me. I do but keep the peace. Put up thy sword, or manage it to part these men with me.
Colin.
What? Drawn and talk of peace? I hate the word, as I hate hell, all Montagues, and thee. Have at thee, coward!
Colin charged at me, and we crashed together like a pair of gamecocks. We lunged and parried until the four girls threw themselves into the fray, jeered on by the hundreds of masked students watching. I took an elbow to the chin and fell heavily to the floor on my back. Colin was on top of me in an instant, reaching for my throat, but I knew Aeschylus would arrive in time to forestall my strangulation. He, or rather she, appeared at the top of the balcony stairs in staggering royal splendor.
Rebellious subjects, enemies to peace, profaners of this neighbor-stained steel, will they not hear?
On the contrary, we all ceased squabbling at once. Colin let go of me, and I rolled onto my knees, gazing up at Meredith in mute amazement. She looked no less a prince than one of us boys would have, rich red hair tied back in a long braid, shapely legs hidden in high leather boots, face shielded by a white mask that shimmered as if it had been dipped in stardust. A floor-length cape swept the stairs behind her as she descended. Meredith.
What ho, you men! You beasts that quench the fire of your pernicious rage with purple fountains issuing from your veins, on pain of torture from those bloody hands, throw your mistempered weapons to the ground and hear the sentence of your moved prince.
We obediently threw our daggers down. Meredith.
Three civil brawls, bred of an airy word, have thrice disturbed the quiet of our streets, and made Verona's ancient citizens cast by their grave-beseeming ornaments to wield old partisans in hands as old, cankered with peace, to part your cankered hate.
She walked slowly between us, head held high. Colin stepped back and bowed. I and the other girls had each sunk to one knee. Meredith looked down at me and lifted my chin with one gloved hand.
If you ever disturb our streets again, your lives shall pay the forfeit of the peace.
She turned on her heel, the hem of her cape snapping across my face.
For this time, all the rest depart away.
The girls and Colin bent to gather their discarded weapons and lost bits of costume, but the prince was impatient.
Once more, on pain of death, all men depart!
We scattered from the center of the room, which erupted in applause as Meredith ascended the stairs to the balcony again. I hovered at the edge of the crowd, watching her feet on the steps until she was gone, then turned to the nearest reveler, a boy, I didn't know who, only his brown eyes visible through the holes in his mask, and said,
"Oh, where is Romeo?"
To another spectator,
"Saw you him today? Right glad I am he was not at this fray."
At exactly that moment,
Romeo emerged from a door on the east wall, clad all in blue and silver, his mask gently curving back toward his temples. He seemed almost a mythical figure, Ganymede, caught beautifully between man and boy. I knew it would be James, had guessed as much, but his appearance was no less affecting.
"See where he comes?"
I said to the girl nearest me in a softer tone. That strange possessive pride washed over me again. Everyone in the room was watching James, how could they not? But I was the only one who really knew him, every inch.
"So please you, step aside. I'll know his grievance or be much denied."
"Good morrow, cousin."
James looked up, looked right at me. He seemed surprised to see me standing there, though I didn't know for the life of me why he should be. Was I not always his right-hand man, his lieutenant? Banquo or Benvolio or Oliver? Little difference. We argued lightly about his unrequited love, a game emerging wherein I blocked his way each time he tried to leave, attempted to evade my questions. He was content to play along until at last he said more firmly,
"Farewell, my cuz."
"Soft," I said. "I will go along, and if you leave me so, you do me wrong."
"Tut, I have lost myself. I am not here. This is not Romeo. He's some other where."
He turned to go, and I darted around to bar his path again. My desire to keep him there had at some point transcended the alignment of an actor's motivation and his character's. I desperately wanted him to stay, seized by the nonsensical idea that if he left, I would lose him irretrievably.
"Tell me in sadness, who is it that you love?"
I said, searching the parts of his face I could see for a flicker of reciprocal feeling. "James,
a sick man in sadness makes his will, a word ill-urged to one that is so ill. In sadness, cousin, I do love a woman."
For a moment I forgot which line of mine followed. We stared at each other, and the crowd faded around us into indistinct shadow and set dressing. With a jolt, I remembered my words, but not quite the right ones. "Be ruled by me," I said, a few lines too soon. "Forget to think of her." James blinked rapidly behind his mask, but then he stepped back, detached, and carried on. I stood still and watched him pace around, his words, his footsteps, his gestures, everything restless. A servant entered with news of the Capulets' upcoming feast. We gossiped, planned, and plotted, until a third masker finally entered. Alexander. He spoke his first line from where he was sitting on the edge of the punch table, his arms draped around the two nearest audience members, one of whom was giggling uncontrollably behind her mask, while the other shrank away from him, obviously terrified.
"Nay, gentle Romeo, we must have you dance."
He slid off the table so smoothly that he might have been made of liquid and approached with his loping feline gait. He nudged me out of his way, walked around James in a small circle, pausing to eye him from every intriguing angle. They volleyed words and quips between them, easy and inconsequential, until James said,
"Is love a tender thing? It is too rough, too rude, too boisterous, and it pricks like thorn."
Alexander released a purring laugh and seized James by the front of his doublet. Alexander.
"If love be rough with you, be rough with love. Prick love for pricking, and you beat love down. Give me a case to put my visage in. A visor for a visor."
The foreheads of their masks knocked together, Alexander holding James so tightly I heard him grunt in pain. I started toward them, but as soon as I moved, Alexander shoved him backward right into my arms. Alexander.
"What care I what curious eye doth quote deformities? Here are the beetle brows shall blush for me."
I pushed James upright again and said, "Come, Knock and enter, and no sooner in, but every man betake him to his legs.
Alexander. Come, we burn daylight, ho!
James.
Nay, that's not so.
Alexander, impatiently.
I mean, sir, in delay, we waste our lights in vain like lamps by day. Take our good meaning, for our judgment sits 5 times in that, ere once in our 5 wits.
James.
And we mean well in going to this mask, but 'tis no wit to go.
Alexander. Why, may one ask?
James.
I dreamed a dream tonight.
Alexander.
And so did I.
James.
Well, what was yours?
Alexander.
That dreamers often lie.
James.
In bed asleep, while they do dream things true.
Alexander.
Oh, then I see Queen Mab hath been with you.
I retreated 2 steps to watch the peculiar monologue unfold. Alexander's Mercutio was razor-edged, unbalanced, barely sane. His sharp incisors flashed in the light when he smiled, his mask glittering mischievously as he danced around, first toying with one spectator, then another. His voice and movement both grew more sensual and more savage until he completely lost control and lunged at me. I staggered backward, but not fast enough. He grabbed me by the hair, bent my head back against his shoulder, snarling in my ear.
Alexander. This is the hag when maids lie on their backs that presses them and learns them first to bear, making them women of good carriage. This is she.
I strained against his hold, but his strength was iron, overwrought, at odds with the delicacy of one fingertip tracing the embroidery on my chest. James, who had been watching, frozen stiff, fought off his paralysis and pulled Alexander off me.
Peace, peace, Mercutio, peace!
He took Alexander's face in his hands.
Thou talkst of nothing.
Alexander's distracted eyes latched onto James's, and he spoke more slowly. Alexander.
True, I talk of dreams, which are the children of an idle brain begot of nothing but vain fantasy, which is as thin of substance as the air and more inconstant than the wind.
When it was my turn to speak again, I spoke carefully, wondering if Alexander was truly now safe. Our conversation from earlier in the evening was too close, too recent to ignore, like a fresh smarting scratch on my skin.
Me. This wind you talk of blows us from ourselves.
Supper is done, and we shall come too late. James turned his face skyward, squinting up at the pyramid of glass that seemed so distant, searching in the wash of light from the chandeliers for the secret, far-off glimmer of a star. I thought of the night of the party when he and I had stood together in the garden, peering up at the heavens through a jagged hole in the treetops. Our last isolated, innocent moment. The stillness that precedes the blows and billows of a storm.
James.
I fear too early, for my mind misgives some consequence yet hanging in the stars shall bitterly begin his fearful date with this night's revels and expire the term of a despised life closed in my breast by some vile forfeit of untimely death.
He paused, gazing upward in soft surprise, sadness like drops of blue in both his eyes. Then he sighed and, smiling, shook his head.
James. But he that hath the steerage of my course, direct my sails. On, lusty gentlemen!
I had almost forgotten where we were, who we were even. But then the orchestra struck up again and reality came rushing back. Another soaring waltz filled the atrium and breathed life into the audience that had gone silent during the previous scene. The Capulet's ball was suddenly in full swing. Alexander grabbed the nearest girl and dragged her forcefully into a dance. The other players appeared from the makeshift wings and did the same, choosing partners at random, pushing other partygoers together. Soon the room was a whirl of movement, surprisingly graceful, considering the number of couples. I found a partner at my elbow, indistinguishable from all the other girls except for a black ribbon tied around her throat, and bowed to her before we began to dance. As we turned and revolved and changed places, my attention was constantly elsewhere. Philippa appeared in the corner of my eye, her mask black, silver, purple. She, too, was dressed as male, dancing with another girl, and I wondered if she might be Paris. I turned and lost sight of her again. I looked for James, looked for Meredith, but could not find them, either one. The song persisted, in my opinion, over long. When it ended, I bowed again, hastily, and ducked out of the room, making a beeline for the back stairs to the balcony. It was quiet there and deeply dark. A few couples had sought that secrecy and were maskless now, joined at the lips, pressed close against the walls. The music had begun again, but slower. The lights dimmed, burned blue, except for one bright white circle where James stood alone. When the light struck him, the surrounding dancers drew back, fell silent. James.
What lady is that, which doth enrich the hand of yonder knight?
The audience turned to see what he was staring at. And there, faint and ephemeral as a ghost, was Wren. A blue and white mask framed her eyes, but she was unmistakably herself. My fingers curled around the edge of the balustrade. I leaned as far forward as I could without falling. James,
did my heart love till now? Forswear it, sight, for I ne'er saw true beauty till this night.
The music rose again. Wren and her borrowed partner turned slowly on the spot and in pantomime bade farewell. James's feet carried him closer, his eyes fixed on her as if he were afraid that she would simply disappear if he lost sight of her. When he was close enough, he caught her hand and she turned to see who had touched her.
James, if I profane with my unworthiest hand this holy shrine, the gentle sin is this. My lips, two blushing pilgrims ready stand to smooth that rough touch with a tender kiss.
He lowered his head and kissed her palm. Her breath ruffled his hair when she spoke.
Wren. Good pilgrim, you do wrong your hand too much, which mannerly devotion shows in this. For saints have hands that pilgrims' hands do touch, and palm to palm is holy palmer's kiss.
Partway through her speech, they eased into motion together, palm to palm, revolving slowly. They paused, changed hands, and stepped together in the opposite direction.
James, have not saints' lips and holy palmers too?
Wren.
Aye, pilgrim, lips that they must use in prayer.
James.
Oh then, dear saint, let lips do what hands do. They pray, grant thou, lest faith turn to despair.
Wren.
Saints do not move, though grant for prayer's sake.
James.
Then move not, while my prayer's effect I take.
They were motionless. James's finger brushed her cheek. He turned her face up toward his and kissed her, so softly that she might not have even felt it.
James, thus from my lips by thine, my sin is purged.
Wren,
then have my lips the sin that they have took?
James,
sin from thy lips? O trespass sweetly urged, give me my sin again.
He kissed her once more, this time long and lingering. My mask was hot and sticky on my face.
my stomach twisted inside out and aching like an open wound. I leaned heavily on the balustrade, trembling under the weight of parallel truths that I had, until then, been able to ignore. James was in love with Wren, and I was blindly, savagely jealous. Act 4. Prologue. It's shorter than I remember, I tell Colborne as we stand looking down the dock toward the water. Back then it felt like it went on for miles. We've wandered through the woods to the south side of the lake, talking quietly. Colborne listens with unfailing patience, weighing and evaluating every word. I turn to him and ask, "Are the kids even allowed down here anymore?"
"We can't exactly stop them, but once they realize it's just a dock and there's nothing to see, they lose interest. We have more of a problem with people stealing stuff that used to be yours."
This has never occurred to me, and I stare at him. "Like what?" He shrugs.
"Old books, costume pieces, the photo of your class in the hall behind the theater. We got that one back, but not before someone scratched your face out."
He sees the confusion in my expression and adds,
"It's not all bad. I still get letters trying to convince me that you're innocent."
"Yeah," I say. "I get those too."
"Are you convinced yet?"
"No. I know better." I walk down the dock and Colborne follows one step behind. I know I owe him a new ending for our old story, but I find it unexpectedly difficult to continue. Up until Christmas, we could pretend that we were mostly all right, or that we would be, someday. I stop at the end, looking down into the water. I've aged well, one might say. My hair is still dark, my eyes still clear, bright blue, my body firmer and stronger than it was before prison. I need glasses now to read, but besides that and a few extra scars, I haven't changed much. I feel older than 31. How old is Colborne now? I don't ask, but I could. Our relationship is not inhibited by expectations of politeness. We stand with our toes peeking over the edge of the dock, not speaking. The green smell of the water is so familiar that I feel a soft tug at the back of my throat. "We didn't come down here as much when it was cold out," I say without prompting. "Between Thanksgiving and Christmas, we mostly kept to the castle and sat around the fire, scratching out speeches and scansion. It almost felt normal, except that empty chair. I don't think I ever saw anyone sit in it after he died. We were a bit superstitious, I guess. Plays full of witches and ghosts will do that to you." Colborne nods vaguely. Then his expression changes, shifts, brow furrowing.
"You blame Shakespeare for any of it?"
The question is so unlikely, so nonsensical, coming from such a sensible man, that I can't suppress a smile.
"I blame him for all of it," I say.
He mimics my smile, though his is tentative, unsure of where the humor really is.
"Why's that?"
It's hard to put into words. I pause, waste a minute trying to collect my thoughts, then proceed without having collected anything at all. We spent 4 years, and most of us years before that, immersed in Shakespeare, submerged. Here we could indulge our collective obsession. We spoke it as a second language, conversed in poetry, and lost touch with reality a little. I reconsider. Well, that's misleading. Shakespeare is real, but his characters live in a world of real extremes. They swing from ecstasy to anguish, love to hate, wonder to terror. It's not melodrama, though. They're not exaggerating. Every moment is crucial. I glance sideways at him, unsure if I'm making any sense. He's still wearing that uncertain half-smile, but he nods, so I continue. A good Shakespearean actor, a good actor of any stripe really, doesn't just say words. He feels them.
We felt all the passions of the characters we played as if they were our own. But a character's emotions don't cancel out the actor's. Instead, you feel both at once. Imagine having all your own thoughts and feelings tangled up with all the thoughts and feelings of a whole other person. It can be hard sometimes to sort out which is which. I slow down, come to a stop, frustrated by my own inability to express myself, a frustration exacerbated by the fact that after 10 years, I still think of myself as an actor. Colburn watches me with keen, curious eyes. I wet my lips with my tongue and proceed more carefully. Our sheer capacity for feeling got to be so unwieldy that we staggered under it, like Atlas with the weight of the world. I sigh, and the freshness of the air derails me. How long will it take, I wonder, for me to get used to it again? My chest aches, and maybe it's the unfamiliar purity of the air, but maybe not. The thing about Shakespeare is he's so eloquent. He speaks the unspeakable. He turns grief and triumph and rapture and rage into words, into something we can understand. He renders the whole mystery of humanity comprehensible. I stop, shrug. You can justify anything if you do it poetically enough. Colburn lowers his eyes, looks down into the white glare of the sun on the water.
Do you think Richard would agree?
I think Richard was under Shakespeare's spell as much as the rest of us. Colburn accepts this without protest.
You know, it's strange, he says. Every now and then I have to remind myself that I never actually knew him.
You would have loved or hated him.
What makes you say that?
That's how he was.
What about you? Did you love him or hate him?
Usually both at once.
Is this what you mean about feeling everything twice?
Ah, I say. You see? You do understand me. The quiet that follows is comfortable, at least for me. I forget why we're there for a moment and watch as a leaf breaks loose from a tree and comes twirling down on the breeze to land on the water. Rings ripple out toward the edges of the lake but disappear before they ever get there. I can almost see the 7 of us running along the bank through the trees, tearing our clothes off, racing to the water, ready to fall in all together. Third year, the year of the comedy, light and delightful and distant. Days we can't have back.
Well,
Colburn says when he's waited long enough for me to speak.
What's next?
Christmas. I turn away toward the forest. The castle is close now, the tower soaring up out of the trees, its long shadow falling over the ramshackle boathouse. That's when everything went wrong.
How did it start?
He asks.
It had already started. Then what changed?
We were separated, I say. James went to California, Meredith to New York, Alexander to Philadelphia, Wren to London, Philippa, who knows where. I went back to Ohio. Being trapped together in the castle with our guilt and Richard's ghost, it was terrible in a way. But being divided from each other, flung to every corner of the world to face it on our own, that was worse.
So what happened?
He asks. We cracked up, I say, but the phrase feels wrong. It was not so simple or so clean as a piece of fractured glass. But we didn't really shatter until we were all back together again. Scene 1. Christmas in Ohio was disastrous. I survived the 4 preceding days by maintaining a state of mild intoxication and conversing only when required. Christmas Eve passed uneventfully, but Christmas dinner, the thrilling sequel to Thanksgiving dinner a month before, ended in an uproar when Caroline left the table for a suspiciously long time, and my father caught her in the bathroom, flushing most of her food down the toilet. 3 hours later, she and my parents were shouting at one another in the dining room. I had fled the scene and was already packing my suitcase, which gaped open in the middle of my unmade bed. I balled up half a dozen scarves and about as many socks and flung them in.
"Oliver!"
Leah blocked the doorway, sobbing at me, as she'd been doing for the last 10 minutes.
"You can't leave now!"
"I have to." I swept an armful of books off my desk and dumped them on top of the scarves. "I can't take this. I need to get out of here." My father's voice thundered from the floor below, and Leah whimpered. "You should get out, too." I nudged her out of the way and grabbed my coat off the hook on the back of the door. "Go to a friend's house or something."
"Oliver!"
she wailed, and I turned away, unable to look at her when her face was screwed up like an infant's, slick and shining with tears. I threw a pile of clothes, dirty or clean, I had no idea and it didn't matter, into the suitcase and slammed it closed. The zipper skated easily around the edge because I'd only packed half of what I'd come home with. Downstairs, my mother and Caroline were both screaming at the same time. I pulled my coat on and yanked the suitcase off the bed, nearly crushing my sister's foot. "Come on, Leah," I said. "You've got to let me go."
"You're just going to leave me?"
I clenched my teeth against a surge of guilt coming up like bile from the pit of my stomach. "I'm sorry," I said, then pushed past her through the door.
"Oliver!"
she yelled, hanging over the banister as I rushed down the stairs.
"Where are you going?"
I didn't answer. I didn't know. I dragged my suitcase down a driveway dusted with powdered sugar snow and waited on the curb for the cab I'd called before packing my bag, wondering what on earth to do next. Delacour's campus was closed for Christmas. I couldn't afford a hotel room in Broadwater or a plane ticket to California. Philadelphia wasn't far, but I was residually angry with Alexander and didn't want to see him. Philippa would have been my best option, but I had no idea where she was or how to get in touch. I had the cab drop me at the bus station, where I called Meredith from a payphone, explained what had happened, and asked if her Thanksgiving offer still stood. There was no bus Christmas night, so I had 6 hours to sit outside the station, shivering and second-guessing my decision. By morning, I was so cold I didn't care how bad an idea it was and immediately bought a ticket to Port Authority. I slept almost the whole way, with my face crushed against the grimy window. When we arrived, I called again and she gave me an address on the Upper East Side. Her parents, eldest brother and sister-in-law, were once again in Canada. Even with me and her and Caleb, the middle sibling, unattached, going kicking and screaming into his 30s, the apartment felt empty and untouched, like a set from a television show. The furniture was expensive, stylish, and uncomfortable, the decor done in blinding white and dull slate gray. In the living room, the Architectural Digest aesthetic was blighted by evidence of occupation, a dog-eared copy of Bonfire of the Vanities, half-drunk bottles of wine, an Armani overcoat tossed carelessly over one arm of the couch. The only indication that a holiday had come and gone was a menorah with 4 half-melted candles sitting crookedly in the window.
"We suck at being Jewish," Meredith explained.
Her room was smaller than I expected, but a high, sloped ceiling kept it from feeling cramped. Compared to her room in the castle, it was ferociously tidy, her clothes tucked away in closets and drawers, books neatly arranged by subject on their shelves. What first caught my eye was the vanity table. It was cluttered with black tufted brushes, sleek tubes of lipstick and mascara, but so many photos had been stuck in the frame that the mirror itself was hardly usable. The one picture of her and her brothers, they were striking children, all auburn hair and green eyes, sitting 3 in a row like Russian nesting dolls on the bumper of a black Mercedes, was wedged in the topmost corner. The rest were of us.
Ren and Richard, faces painted black and white for our second-year mime class. Alexander in the gallery, pretending to share a cigarette with Homer. Meredith and Philippa in cut-off shorts and bikini tops, sprawled in the shallow water on the north shore of the lake as if they'd fallen from the sky and landed there. James, smiling but not at the camera, one hand shyly raised to push the lens away, the other arm hooked around my neck. Me, unaware that we were being photographed, laughing into the distance, a bright autumn leaf caught in my hair. I stood staring at the wistful collage she'd created until I felt a lump form in my throat. When I glanced over my shoulder at the pristine impersonality of the rest of the room, the smooth, flat bedspread, the bare hardwood floor, it occurred to me at last how alone she was. Unable, as always, to find the words to express my own belated understanding, I said nothing. For 3 days, Meredith and I lounged around, reading, talking, not touching, as Caleb came and went, indifferent to my presence, rarely sober, always on the phone with someone. Like his sister, he was almost unfairly good-looking, their shared features strangely, though not unpleasantly delicate and feminine in him. He had a quick smile, but his eyes were distant, as though his mind was perpetually preoccupied with important business elsewhere. He did promise, though it made little difference to us, an extravagant New Year's party. Caleb, for all his shortcomings, was a man of his word. By 9:30 on December 31st, the apartment was packed with people in glamorous party attire. I knew none of them. Meredith, only a handful, Caleb, a quarter of them at best. By 11, everyone was drunk, including me and Meredith, but when people started snorting lines of coke off the kitchen counter, we slipped out unnoticed with 2 bottles of Laurent Perrier. Times Square, like the apartment, was teeming with people, and Meredith clung to my arm to keep from being swept away down the sidewalk by the crowd. We laughed and stumbled and drank pink champagne straight from the bottle until it was confiscated by an exasperated police officer. Snow fell like confetti on our heads and shoulders and stuck in Meredith's eyelashes. She glimmered in the night like a precious stone, vivid and flawless. I drunkenly told her as much, and at midnight we kissed on a Manhattan street corner, one of a million couples all kissing at the same time. We wandered the city until the champagne wore off and the cold set in, then clumsily made our way back to the apartment. All was dark and quiet. The last partygoers sprawled on the living room furniture, asleep or too high to move. We crept to Meredith's room, stripped off our wet layers, and huddled under the blankets on her bed. The search for warmth turned slowly but predictably to more kissing, then gradual undressing, cautious touches, and eventually, inevitably, sex. Afterward, I waited for the guilt to come, the compulsion to beg Richard's phantom for forgiveness. But for once, when I most expected to open my eyes and find him standing over me, he declined to show himself. Instead, the silhouette I saw on the wall belonged inexplicably to James, who had no business in that room, in my thoughts, at that moment. Anger rushed through me, but before it went to my head, Meredith moved, nestled closer, interrupted the illusion. I exhaled, relieved to think she'd woken me from some disturbed half-dream. I let my fingertips trail from the tip of her shoulder to the smooth inward curve of her waist, comforted by how soft and feminine she was. Her head rested on my chest, and I wondered if she felt the fleeting stillness of my fitful, troubled soul. The next 3 days passed in much the same way. By night we drank just barely too much, tolerated Caleb as long as we could, then tumbled into bed together. By day we roamed New York, wasted time and the Dardennes' money in bookstores and theaters and cafes, talking about life after Delacour, realizing at last that it was only a few months away. We'd had so much else on our minds. "They'll have scouts down for the spring production," Meredith said one afternoon as we wandered away from the Strand. empty-handed only because we'd been there once already.
And then we'll have the showcase in May. I haven't even thought about what I'll read.
She nudged me with her elbow.
We ought to do a scene together. We could be, oh, I don't know, Margaret and Suffolk.
She tossed her head and said airily,
Would you carry my heart like a jewel in a box?
I don't know. Would you carry my head around in a basket if I got decapitated by pirates? She looked at me like I was crazy, but then, to my relief and my delight, she laughed. The sound wild and lovely, like a tiger lily bursting open. When her mirth had subsided, she glanced around at the other people on the sidewalk, moving in a steady stream toward Union Square.
How odd it'll be, she said more soberly, to have everyone here in the city.
It'll be fun, I told her, wondering if we'd all stay with her the week of the showcase, sleep on the floor like it was a middle school slumber party. Like a test run. This time next year, we'll all probably be living here.
You think so?
Well, we've got to go somewhere there's Shakespeare. Will you stay in the apartment?
God, no. I need to get out of there.
Then I guess you'll have to move into some hovel in Queens with the rest of us. I leaned toward her until our shoulders bumped together and she gave me a tentative smile.
We're all going to live on top of each other like it's the castle all over again?
I don't see why not. The smile slipped and she shook her head.
It won't be the same.
I looped one arm around her neck, pulled her close, and kissed her temple. I felt her sigh, and when she breathed her sadness out, I breathed it in. No, it wouldn't be the same. I couldn't argue with that. On Sunday evening, we flew back to O'Hare, first class, Caleb's treat. We were the first to arrive at the castle, as classes didn't resume until Wednesday. I was grateful for this. Whatever Meredith and I were doing, we hadn't actually talked about it since our unfortunate date at the Boar's Head, I wasn't ready to discuss it with anyone else. I tore the LaGuardia tag off my suitcase and left it at the foot of my bed. For a moment, I paused, staring into James's corner of the room. What with family histrionics and the enormous distraction of Meredith, I'd managed to push him for a week or two out of my mind. I'd told myself that the jealousy dismay that seized me during the Christmas mask was merely a moment of insanity, a side effect of manipulative theater magic. But as I stood there in the tower with his shadow in the room, I felt it come creeping slowly back again. I went unsteadily down the stairs and spent one more night with Meredith, the only cure I could think of. Scene 2. Second semester auditions were posted on the call board first thing Wednesday morning. All fourth years, second years, and invited third years, please prepare a 2-minute monologue for King Lear. The audition and rehearsal schedules were posted below. Alexander would audition first, unobserved, then he'd watch Wren's audition, she'd watch mine, I'd watch Philippa's, she'd watch James's, and he'd watch Meredith's. We spent the next week scrambling to prepare new audition pieces, universally surprised by the choice of production. Lear had never in 50 years been attempted at Delacour, likely because, as Alexander pointed out, having a tender 20-something in the title role would be entirely absurd. How Frederick and Gwendolyn intended to address this problem, we couldn't guess. At 8 on the evening of the auditions, I sat alone in our usual booth at the Boar's Head, attracting dirty looks from larger parties waiting for a table. Meredith had just left me to prepare for her own reading, and Philippa, I guessed, would be arriving shortly. I'd watched her audition, an excellent take on Tamora, and was eager to discuss casting with somebody else who had already read. Alexander and Wren were nowhere to be found. I finished my beer, but I didn't leave the table, certain it would be stolen if I got up to go to the bar. Fortunately, Philippa breezed in from outside after only 5 minutes or so. Her hair was windswept and tangled, cheeks glowing pink from the sting of the cold gusts blowing snow down the street. As she sat down, I said, "Drink?"
God, yes. Something warm.
I slid out of the booth as she piled her outer layers, scarf, hat, gloves, coat, in the corner. I returned from the bar with two mugs of hot cider, and Philippa raised hers in a silent toast before gulping down a mouthful.
I think hell may have frozen over, I said, brushing bits of snow that had fallen from her hat and scarf off the bench beside me.
I'll believe that when I see the cast list. She wiped a sticky drop of cider from her lips.
What do you think they'll do?
If I had to guess? No clue about Lear, but obviously Wren will be Cordelia. You and Meredith will be Regan and Goneril. I'll probably be Albany. James will be Edgar, and Alexandra will be Edmund.
I wouldn't be too sure about that last bit.
Why not? She shifted in her seat and glanced at the next booth, where a trio of dancers sat sipping long-stemmed glasses of white wine. When she leaned low over the table, I instinctively mimicked her. We were so close that a strand of her hair tickled my forehead.
So I just watched James's audition, she said. What did he read?
I asked. He wouldn't tell me.
Richard Plantagenet, 2 Henry VI. And force perforce I'll make him yield the crown, whose bookish rule hath pulled fair England down.
Really? That speech is so, I don't know, aggressive. Doesn't really seem his style.
Yeah. As soon as he got to, a day will come when York shall claim his own, it was like he was a different person all of a sudden.
She shook her head slowly.
You should have seen it, Oliver. He scared me. Honestly.
I was mute for a moment, then shrugged. Good for him. She gave me a look so deeply skeptical that I almost laughed.
Pip, I mean it, I said. Good for him. He said at the beginning of the year he was tired of playing a type, and he's always had that kind of range, he's just never had a chance to show it because those sorts of roles were always going to go to Richard. Why bother? He's got a chance now to do something new.
She sighed.
You're probably right. God knows I'd like a chance to do something new.
Maybe they'll change it up this time around. It's a different dynamic. I nodded vaguely toward the end of the table where 6 weeks before Richard might have been sitting. He had become a perpetual blind spot in my, and I suspected the other's, peripheral vision.
Well, you're not wrong, Philippa said, looking away toward the door at nothing in particular. At any rate, I'll be surprised if they don't cast James as Edmund.
I didn't set much stock by her prediction, the more fool I. Our conversation changed course, and 2 hours passed without incident before Meredith came in from outside, bringing a little whirl of snow in with her.
The list is up, and you'll never believe it, she said, slapping the paper down on the table.
I didn't have time to ask where everyone else was. Philippa and I nearly cracked heads trying to see the list at the same time. She choked and sputtered cider across the booth.
Frederick is going to play Lear?
Camillo is Albany? I said.
What the hell?
That's not all, Meredith said, struggling to unwind her scarf.
Read the whole thing. It's utterly insane.
We bent our heads again more cautiously. Frederick and Camillo were listed first, followed by the 4th years, below that the 3rd years, and finally the 2nd years. The cast for King Lear is as follows. King Lear, Frederick Teasdale. Albany, Camillo Varela. Cordelia, Wren Sterling. Regan, Philippa Costa. Goneril, Meredith Darden. Edmund, James Farrow. Edgar, Oliver Marks. Fool, Alexander Voss. Cornwall, Colin Hyland. I stopped reading after Colin's name and gaped up at Meredith.
What on earth have they done?
Fuck knows, she said, still fiddling with the scarf which was tangled in her hair. I instinctively lifted my hand to reach over and help, but my wrist smacked against the underside of the table and I thought better of it.
It's like they mixed all the boys around and then decided that moving the girls was too much effort.
Philippa. Alexander's going to be thrilled.
Me. For what it's worth, I'm thrilled.
Meredith.
Honestly, Oliver, you act like they've done you a favor. It's not as if you haven't earned it.
Her face disappeared as she gave up on untangling the scarf and pulled it off over her head. Philippa looked at me and raised her eyebrows. I could have blamed the cider for the warm, melting sensation in my stomach, but my mug had long been empty. Meredith resurfaced and tossed the offending scarf on top of Philippa's things.
"Is it just you two?" she said.
"It was just me for a while," I said. "Where is everyone?"
"Wren went back to the castle after her audition and went straight to bed," Meredith said. "Don't think she wants to risk another episode."
This was what we had taken to calling Wren's fainting spell during her Lady Anne speech. What exactly was wrong with her, nobody seemed to be able to say. Emotional exhaustion was how the Broadwater doctor described it, but Alexander's diagnosis of guilt complex seemed more likely.
"What about James?" Philippa asked.
"He sat through my audition, but he was in an absolute state the whole time," Meredith said.
"Moody, you know."
This directed at me, though I did not, in fact, know anything of the sort.
"I asked if he was coming to the bar, and he said no. He wanted to go for a walk."
Philippa's eyebrows climbed higher, so high they nearly disappeared into her hair.
"In this weather?" "That's what I said, and he said he wanted to clear his head and that he didn't much care what the cast list said. It would say the same thing in the morning."
I glanced from Meredith to Philippa and said slowly, "Okay. Where does that leave Alexander?"
"Philippa. Probably he's with Colin."
"Me. But how did you know?"
Meredith. "It's not like it's a secret."
"Me.
He said it was."
Philippa.
"Please, the only person who thinks it's a secret is Colin."
I shook my head, glanced around the crowded barroom. Me. "Why do we even pretend anything is private around here?" Meredith.
"Welcome to art school. It's like Gwendolyn always says, when you enter the theater, there are three things you must leave at the door: dignity, modesty, and personal space."
Philippa. "I thought it was dignity, modesty, and personal pride." Me. "She told me dignity, modesty, and self-doubt." All three of us were silent for a moment before Philippa said,
"Well, this explains a lot."
"Do you suppose she has three different things for every student she talks to?" I asked.
"Probably," Meredith said. "I'm just surprised she thought personal space was my biggest issue."
"Maybe she wanted to prepare you to get ogled and groped and borderline sexually assaulted in every play we put on," Philippa said.
"Ha ha, I'm an object, very funny."
Meredith rolled her eyes.
"I swear I should have just been a stripper."
Philippa smirked into her mug and said, "Everyone needs a backup plan."
"Yeah," Meredith said. "You could always get a sex change, become a boy on a permanent basis, and start calling yourself Philip."
They scowled at each other, and in an effort to lighten the mood, I said, "I guess my other option is an existential crisis."
"Not so bad," Philippa said. "You can just play Hamlet."
We drank six more ciders between the three of us, waiting in vain for one of the others to make an appearance. Never before had there been so little interest in a new cast list. Even as we drank and talked and laughed half-heartedly, it was impossible to ignore the fact that everyone's priorities had changed. Wren was too fragile to make the usual walk from the fab to the bar. James too distracted. Alexander otherwise occupied. The whims governing the Delacour staff were similarly unfathomable. Why had they suddenly lifted their half-century boycott of Lear and wedged Frederick and Camillo in with the rest of us? I told myself as I gathered my coat and gloves at the end of the night that they were simply trying to fill the hole Richard had left behind. But another nagging voice at the back of my mind kept asking whether there might be an ulterior motive. Was it possible that they, like Colborne, didn't trust us? Perhaps Frederick and Camillo were more than castmates and teachers.
Perhaps they'd at last begun to realize what danger we were in.